one addressed to Ben Isquith, the L'Enfant Terrible from Tibernia. Word zero comes from Italian Zephyrium or Zephyro. Leonard of Pisa wrote a book on Arabic system of numbers in 1202 a year. His word zero came from the Arabic sifr, S-I-F-R, or cipher, which is a translation of the Hindu sunya, meaning empty or void. Reserve space for me if the Baltimore trip is serving mint julep. Otherwise, in such a minus atmosphere, could not add or subtract a zero. Love from your constant listener, Olga Spofford Maranzano. Here's the one that seems to be a slight beef. C.B. Bauer asks Carr, what about Kehoe's magnetic field theory of propulsion? Impossibility flies tonight with a vengeance. We wish you luck from the moon. King Bauer and C.B.
Did you care to comment on that, Mr. Carr?
No comment.
All right, fine. Next one?
The next one is Maxwell, the scientist, I assume, mathematically identified light wave with electromagnetic wave. Hertz found them identical in velocity and property. Carr accepts the electromagnetic theory and denies fundamental light law. If light speed varies, does electromagnetic field vary? That's signed A. Osgood.
We were conjecturing about a system outside our own solar system. And this was conjectural. In our own solar system, our craft is built upon the measurements that we know, the velocity of light and electromagnetic waves.
A little question. I was curious about this thing that these revolving cones seem to pass over, it's again hard to describe, they seem to pass over like intricately revolving magnetic copper wound coils, I should say. Do you supply any motive power to this?
All of the energy comes from these two cones. This, in the vernacular, would be a battery. The big novelty here is that we have put a battery in motion. We have designed it according to accepted knowledge of the total dimensions of space matter, and we have activated it electrochemically, and then we use this electrochemical activation to activate the entire craft, after which we have motion as the feature of this accumulator, which in the vernacular is a battery.
Ben Isquith.
Mr. Carr, I wanted to ask you this. Mr. Osgood's telegram, I think, brought up a very important and perhaps even crucial point. Mainly, it's quite true that James Clerk Maxwell demonstrated that light is an electromagnetic radiation. Also, which was experimentally verified by Hertz, who actually laid the foundation for modern radio. Now, the speed of an electromagnetic radiation, such as radio waves, is also 186,000 miles per second. In other words, light and all forms of electromagnetic radiation is constant at the speed of 186,000 miles per second. Now, it's presuming, if it were possible, for your craft to travel faster than the speed of light, it could therefore travel faster than the speed of electromagnetic radiation. So once it exceeded the speed of 186,000 miles per second, you wouldn't be gaining all this energy from the electromagnetic radiation that you're generating, and wouldn't you fall rapidly downward?
There's a continual falling in space, which in itself can bring velocity and also bring you to another system.
No, I was thinking about this trip 1,000 miles up.
Well, we qualified our answer there by stating that our craft was designed on the basic known principles of the velocity of light within our system and the electromagnetic wave velocity. Now, we mentioned conjecturally that in other systems there could be different velocities, but we are not applying them to our craft. We don't identify them with our craft.
Yeah, fine, but if you go faster than the speed of light...
We didn't... Well, it
you said it was quite possible.
I said in another system, Mr.
All right, in any
possible.
Other system. Right? Right. You'd be going to Altair 7. I mean, I don't care what system
Very
you
possible.
Use.
Very possible.
All right, say you're in Altair 7, and you're going faster than the speed of light. Now, if you're going faster than the speed of light, you're going faster than the speed of electromagnetic radiation. Therefore, you cannot absorb any energy from the electromagnetic motor that you're generating, because
relatively,
you're faster, traveling faster than it's getting out.
Relatively, we would not be able to go faster than this unless we were in a system that permitted it. In our system, of our solar system, our craft, as we have mentioned now three times, is designed on known principles. We conjectured about other systems. If we go beyond the velocity of light in other systems, then the conditions within the system would make it possible for us to continue to have power.
Dave? Ben, you had gotten a little bit beyond where I was. You were going out at the speed of light and had already gotten to Altair 7. I'm still down here on Earth, and I'm not traveling very fast. Let's assume, Mr. Carr, that this vehicle, I presume you'd call it a vehicle, is at rest. What is it that originally overcomes the inertia of this rotor and starts the rotor to moving?
The electromagnetic force that was stored in the energy of the Neutron Electrical Accumulator, which in the vernacular is a battery.
Now, the neutron accumulator is these cones that have apexes inverted to each other with the bases together.
That's true.
Now, I know of batteries such as the zinc-carbon battery with the salmoniac material in between them. I know of the mercury battery and various types of storage batteries, such as the nickel-cadmium cell and the lead-sulfuric acid cell. Does this come within the scope of any of those?
Yes, it does, and we can use any of the principles that you mentioned. What we have here is a tremendous size in comparison to other batteries. Therefore, an accumulation of cells, it's very easy to put 1,000 2-volt cells inside this one unit as we see it externally and have it function very well. In the plan of our 45-foot craft, we plan to have a 12,000-volt battery which will expend an electromotive force of 12,000 volts to energize the electromagnets and the capacitor plates, and the regenerative coils in turn will put back into the battery in this system the same amount of voltage going out until there is a breakdown of electrochemicals and then, of course, a wear out of your system. But it could last as long as our average storage battery in an automobile.
Then in order to start the rotor off originally, it would be necessary to cause a flow of electricity through one set of the coils.
That's true.
Is there any magnetic force in the other set of coils at this particular point?
They are individually operate by circuit breakers, and the first motion begins to start a repetition the same as we have in a motor that has the opposite of the commutator, which is accumulation of contact points wherein each coil is energized as the current flows through this coil. Then this starts the motion, and then the repetition of this motion brings the whole motor into phase. In the same sense, our accumulator and the magnets become speeded up, and the circuits are made and broken as they rotate.
Now, when this is resting on the... when the entire craft is resting on the ground, it seems to me that the outer portion would have a certain amount of resistance from friction provided by the supports resting on the ground, and that the rotor on the inside would be the only thing that would be able to turn. Is that correct?
You're seeing here a model that has a stand that is not a part of the model. The operation is in the smaller model. As we see it here, the power system, there is nothing that is not a part of the unit itself. Now, in our design for a spacecraft, this is the power package. Then we have a cabin, and we have a landing apparatus as a part of it. Now, this can be retractable, the same as in our present flight system.
Now, I have another thing that puzzles me a bit. There are a lot of things, actually, that puzzle me. But in this particular case, where the rotor, or the inner rotor, starts rotating in one direction and the outer rotor starts rotating in the other direction, where are the people?
The people are in the third compartment, and it doesn't rotate.
How is it suspended?
The design is rather simple, and it is incidentally for the saucer enthusiast, it's somewhat like what is known as the Adamski bell in general form, although our streamlining is much better. We have the cabin is the actual center of the craft, and the battery, this accumulator, is below the cabin, and then the electromagnets are the total outside part of the circular foil, this being the cabin here.
Do you believe in the Adamski craft, Mr. Carr? Do you think that George had a real experience?
We believe, after having studied the photographs, that it is a highly functional device. We know nothing about Mr. Adamski or his experiences. We do not know the authenticity. But we do know that such a craft, using our principle, could most assuredly become airborne.
Mr. Carr, there is something that still puzzles me about this. If this cabin or bell in which the crew is housed is located on top of this motivating mechanism, what keeps it from rotating in one direction or the other?
The shaft of the accumulator goes through the cabin, and there is a bearing. Now, just as this stays stationary when this is rotated, so will the cabin, because there are two rotating forces. You have the clockwise rotation of the accumulator, the capacitor plates, and the generator coils. You have a counterclockwise rotation of the entire circular area of the craft, which is the largest diameter parts, which house the electromagnet. Therefore, when you have rotation in one direction and counter-rotation in the other, the cabin itself is like a bearing, like the center part. It's you might say, an accentuation of a shaft.
I guess so.
We've built the models, sir, and proven this is correct.
You built what models, sir?
We have built the actual models. In fact,
of the spacecraft?
Oh, yes. Yes, we have.
Of the OTCX one?
Yes, we have built models, sir.
And what could you accomplish with the models,
sir? We have had six successful airborne flights electromagnetically and one escape flight. We used circuit breakers of various types. Cut off power, And even simple fuses that burned and threw a switch. We lost one craft.
What was the size of them, sir?
The largest model we built and the one we lost was 6 feet in diameter.
When was this, sir?
The date is... we prefer not to mention it due to our patent procedure. It was in the past, but we have patent procedure going on now, and there are certain things involved relating dates.
I was just wondering, Mr. Carr, and I sincerely hope you don't mind our frank line of questioning. I notice in this beautiful brochure that has been presented to me by the OTC Enterprises that you constantly talk about a Kuroto gravity motor. Have I pronounced that correctly, sir?
Kuroto.
Kuroto.
Right.
Gravity motor. You mentioned that it's portable. It requires no fixed location or large building in which to function, and you also say a lot of other wonderful things about the possibility of this motor. Is it possible, Mr. Carr, that you are trying to sell people the idea of the value of this gravity motor, and you're sort of using the spacecraft idea as a bit of showmanship to merchandise something else?
They are two separate power packages. The spacecraft utilizes the electrical accumulator. The gravity motor uses the pressure energy of the inertial attracting forces. We have learned how to take this energy and key it to a work shaft and get work power, which we truly call free energy, because it is. We do not make any part of it. Now, in the rather vulgar vernacular sense, a few years ago, this would have been classified as perpetual motion. It is nothing of the sort. We get free energy in the same manner that stored up power in a hydroelectric dam will continue to furnish energy for the dam to this hydroelectric system, so long as there's a flow of pressure of water into the dam to maintain it. Now, we have learned that all masses that are smaller than the mass to which they're attracted exert energy. Even this ashtray here, if it weighs a pound, if it takes a pound of energy to lift it, then it is exerting a pound of energy. So we have been able to put this to work. We have a true gravity motor, and this is what it is. And its functional operation is to produce work power continuously without any dissipation of the energy that causes it to operate. And we have built models of this, and these models operate and function, and we are in patent procedure on them.
Ben Nisquith.
Well, I was just going to ask, you also have working models of the gravity motor. So, since you answered that, Mr. Carr, I wonder, in the brochure, and in which Mr. Colton has stated it tonight, you've offered the spacecraft to the government. Has there been, to various government agencies, have there been any takers?
Up to the moment, no, sir.
Has anyone been interested? I mean, I imagine that if I was a government official, God forbid, but I was, and I had seen a demonstration of a working model, or someone said they could show me a working model of a spacecraft, I would be very interested in going down and see it. Has any government official been that interested?
We have had the government scientist in our workshop, and this scientist stated that the five questions that he asked us were satisfactorily answered, and that he was satisfied that our ship could become electrically airborne. This was the evaluation he gave us.
Did you show him the working model?
We showed him what you see here.
In other words, not a working model.
We did not show him an activated prototype, no.
Didn't he want to look at one?
I think a lot of people want to look at one, and they will soon get this opportunity. We're in the midst of patent procedure, and until this has been completed, we do not reveal everything.
But since that visit by the government scientists, you haven't heard anything?
Not a thing.
Are you free to tell us what agency he was from?
Mr. Colton, would you care to...
I think I can.
Go ahead,
I have
John.
I information, don't I?
Yes, you do.
This is from the Department of Defense. I have a letter that Mr. Colton turned over to me a moment ago. I can't see the rest of it here because it's stapled down. Let me see if I can get this thing. What's on this letter here.
While you're taking that apart, I'll tell you that the two items you...
Well, you can tell me
there.
If you want. No, it's Department of the Army, of the Chief of Research and Development of Washington, D.C. Now, as soon as I put this together again, these are from the files of OTC Enterprises in Baltimore. I'll read this. This letter is addressed to Mr. Otis T. Carr, President of OTC Enterprises Incorporated, Baltimore, Maryland. And it's dated 23rd day of December 1957. Dear Mr. Carr, in reply to your letter of 16 December 1957, this office has considered the results of the visit on the above date and the discussions with you on 21 November 1957. The results of these conferences do not justify further interest by the Army in your proposal. Your interest in the Army is appreciated. Sincerely, John A. Ord, Colonel and the Chief of the Research Division Office, Chief of R&D. This is not quite clear to me, Mr. Carr. In Mr. Ord's first paragraph, he mentions about a visit. Did he visit your plant in Baltimore?
There were a group of government officials, including a scientist.
That came to your plant in Baltimore?
That is right.
Could you give us any idea of the size of your plant in Baltimore?
Well, this is really a field office. It's not a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a workshop there. We maintain our offices... for our corporate structure and so forth, are all maintained, and all our records in this field office.
Well, now, where are these model spacecrafts, where are they built, sir?
We have built these in our own private laboratory in the past.
And where is that located?
The only workshop we have at the moment is at our present address. That's 2502 North Calvert Street, Baltimore, which is our field office.
In other words, that is the OTC Enterprise as of today.
That is right.
There's no plant, there's no research work that is going on except on the board.
You have seen the projection, the architect's preliminary plan.
Yes, we have.
Institute that we plan to build.
Mm-hmm. When do you plan to build it?
This is a matter of funds. Now, our $20 million offer for the delivery of a 45-foot circlafoil spacecraft includes tooling, and tooling includes this total plant, as you saw in the preliminary architectural drawing.
WOR Radio, 710 on the dial in New York.
Cost will run close with all tooling and all furnishings around $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the other $10 million would be used in the fabrication and checking out and testing the circuit forecast.
I'm interested in a clipping that I have from the Buffalo, New York Courier Express dated December 21st, 1957. The article is headed, Army Rejects Offer to Build Spacecraft. I'm sorry, it's dated Washington, December 20th. It seems that a spokesman
for the Army made this statement. The model shown does not meet present or foreseeable needs of the Army, and the Army has no further interest in the project as presented. Now, if you are correct, sir, in your claim that with this spacecraft, this OTCX-1 spacecraft, that if you had the opportunity to build it, that you can go to the moon in a period of 5 hours, it would seem to me that the Army or any branch of our armed services would certainly be greatly interested in this project.
Novel developments that are totally new have often been rejected, which has nothing to do with their value. I think that there isn't any question about the terrifying energy in the release of fissionable atomic power, but we do know that the first boys who knew how to do it properly even had their patent application turned down and had it rejected, and by the United States, and it was only after one of them, Dr. Fermi, was awarded the Nobel Prize, was his patent even reconsidered. So that it is not unusual to find new and novel things which are far superior to what is accepted being rejected on all sides. This does not qualify the item, the actual, we feel, the demonstration of the model, the building of this principle and proving it will speak for itself. And this is not too far off. However, we do have the problem of the amount of funds were mentioned.
Mr. Carr, if you say that sometimes they're not interested in new ideas, why have they been so interested in attempting to launch so many unsuccessful satellites?
The rocket enthusiasts are the ones who have control of this type of thinking of the moment. I don't know. A rocket is a glorified Chinese firecracker. This principle has been known for well over 1,100 years. Newton gave the true evaluation then of how to properly use it, and then all of a sudden, some scientists found out that the function of a rocket, the reaction principle, worked as well in a vacuum as it did in air resistance, and this rocket age of today was born. We think that it is as dead as a dodo already. We think that when our first craft is built, rockets become museum people.
When your first craft is built?
Right.
You don't feel that there'd be any need for a rocket?
We see no need whatever. To us, it's antiquated.
Mm-hmm. You think that any foreign governments may be familiar with the idea that you have in mind, your plan, sir?
We think that thousands of people all over the world understand this plan very well.
You think that thousands?
We do.
Of people understand the plan?
We think so, yes, sir.
Ben Iskwit?
What I was wondering about the fact that the Army and the Navy, if anything, have been pretty lavish with the research funds concerning potential spacecraft and rocketry. I even remember reading about some kids in Iowa who were members of a high school rocket society who were shooting off their own rockets, and they got one up 200 feet or something, and they supposed to have had some new gimmick, and they got a Navy research contract out of it. And if the Navy is willing to give a research contract to a bunch of high school boys and girls who are working in a rocket society, I don't understand why the Department of Defense is so blind to a spacecraft on an entirely new principle.
Do you want to comment on that? We don't understand either. We haven't refused in the office.
Mr. Carr, we had a gentleman on this program recently, a man by the name of Reinhold O. Schmidt.
Mr. Schmidt lives someplace in California, and he claims that he had a rather unusual experience in Kearney, Nebraska, on the afternoon of November 5th, the year of 1957. He claims he was driving in his 1955 Buick, came to an empty piece of property on the outskirts of Kearney, Nebraska, and a rather strange craft was hovering over this empty piece of property. Eventually it landed. There were six occupants in the craft. He was invited in. Four of them were men. Two were women. They spoke in a high German. And I was wondering if you're familiar with that story and if you have any opinion about Mr. Schmidt's story.
We only know what we read in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for us to express an opinion. We know that an electrified craft can become airborne. We have done it. We know that ours work. We have never seen one except in the air at high velocity.
And possibly the ones that you've seen are from other planets?
There is a great possibility, yes.
Or is it possible that they, their origin may be from some foreign country?
We question that any country which is still pursuing, and it seems to be that all countries are pursuing the missile program and the so-called intercontinental ballistic missile and so forth, if they had an electrified craft such as we know can be built, why are they proceeding the other way? They are doing now. We don't know this answer, and we therefore can only assume that what has been seen legitimately, and I don't say that any of these stories are not, because I don't know. I have no way of investigating them. But we do know that there are some very excellent observers who are scientists and who have seen electrified objects in the air. We know that the Lubeck lights have never been explained. And they were seen by scientists, and they were properly photographed, and they were certainly luminescent.
Mr. Carr, prior to the year, well, I think you did mention the first 15 to 20 minutes that we started our discussion this morning, that back in the year of 1937, that you had this idea of developing this unusual type of spacecraft, and that you incorporated, that is, OTC Enterprises, was incorporated in the year of 1955. Between the years of 37 and 55, what was your source of livelihood, sir? Your source of income? Primarily the development of this?
No. We worked at other tasks in order to maintain ourselves, and spent all the funds that we could get our hands on to continue experiments. We maintained a laboratory in New York City, up around 63rd Street to Amsterdam Avenue. From 1938 to close to 1942. And we moved to Baltimore, and we opened up our small experimental workshop there and maintained it. All our time in Baltimore, we were a desk clerk at the Southern Hotel until we had completed our experiments.
You're using the editorial we again.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You're not referring to Mr. Colton?
No, sir. No, I'm sorry. It's the editorial we, mm-hmm, myself. And to further answer the question, when we had met with complete success, we organized our corporation and started to lay the groundwork to start to build this first craft.
To go back to your question a while ago and the analogy we were building up with the Earth as a spaceship, taking another look at the mock-up prototype power package there in front of you, it resembles the solar system itself, and as a matter of fact, one of the statements in the brochure which Mr. Carr published back in October 1957, says we have translated the geometry of the universe, and in the sense that this device miniaturizes and essentially duplicates the motions of bodies in the solar system, is the source of its ability to also miniaturize their energies. So that in the sense that the bodies in the solar system in all time have maintained their constant motions, they are perpetually in those motions, and this is why sometimes people characterize this power package as a perpetual motion machine, while we do not make any such claim.
There was a fascinating book that appeared many years ago. I believe it was called The Descent of the Atom. It was an anonymously written book, and at first it appeared to be, I've been looking for this person, it appeared to have been written by a scientist who did not want to give his name, decided to go a little bit offbeat, and from left field published a private theory, which incidentally has been done.
So I published it under my pen name of Tex Dumont Jr.
I was afraid of that. The point of the whole theory, I would encourage this boy. Don't encourage him. He's sick. According to this book, he figured it out this way, well, now look, the solar system is an atom. An atom of what? Looking at the planets, their numbers, and so forth, he came to the conclusion that this large atom, solar system as an atom, must have been an atom of fluorine. This is no gag. And he felt that there were magnitudes involved, and he, I believe, stopped at something like the 11th magnitude. However, the book was not very scholarly, and in view of the newfound author, I can see why. It was not too good, actually. In other words, the conclusions that he, the way he arrived at his conclusions indicated that he was not much of a scientist. Since then, a number of scientists have, however, speculated with the concept of the solar system as an atom or other solar systems as atoms and have been inclined to reject it on somewhat more valid grounds than the original concept was held to be valid. That's all.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but this has been so interesting to me, and I sincerely hope to our 8 listeners, that may I apologize in advance to say that I'm going to take care of a little business, and as they say in this business, I'm going to put them back to back.
We are so mixed up here with all the equipment that we have. We have miniature mock flying saucers, and I've got a tremendous cup of cold tea, and we've got all sorts of things around the table, and let me just tell you, maybe you just joined us. You got $20 million? A lot of money? Yes, it is. That's a real classical buck, $20 million. But let me just tell you what you can get for $20 million. Of course, this is the delivered price. The delivered price of the OTCX-1 circular foil spacecraft. And that $20 million, well, that's payable in full on delivery. You know, none of these, you know, type of bits where no down payment, you know, so much a month or anything. You got to have it all at one time. So it's payable in full on delivery with no prior commitment required, and including all tooling and other overhead to you, $20 million. And if you've got a friend or a neighbor next door that would like to get one at the same time, we can make a special deal for you by tossing one extra one in for an extra $4 million. That means $24 million for the two of them. And of course, I'm talking about a spacecraft. I'm talking about a flying saucer. Now, this is not a gag. We're not kidding you this morning. We're really down to earth, and I'm squaring you off. But if you own one, you won't be down to earth very long, because when you get into that OTCX-1 circular foil spacecraft, you can go to the moon in 5 hours. No, I'm giving it to you straight this morning. This is just what we're being told by members of OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland. And if we had picture radio this morning,
I can assure you we would have just about the most amazing thing to put on camera, because we have the plans in front of us, we have the models in front of us, and we have just about everything, including some very colorful and very beautiful brochures. And our guests are Otis T. Carr, president of OTC Enterprises Incorporated, and Norman Evans Colton, director of sales engineering of OTC Enterprises. Now, OTC Enterprises Incorporated are willing to demonstrate that the OTCX1 craft will depart from any specified location in the continental United States, orbit one or more times outside the Earth's atmosphere, and land its crew safely within the inner rotunda courtyard of the Pentagon building in Washington, or at any other location best suited to public observation. Now, when you hear that, I know a lot of people say, well, now, is John pulling our leg? No, we're not pulling your leg. We're telling you just what we have in front of us, all of these facts. You see, the OTCX1 craft is to be of circular foil design, approximately 45 feet in diameter and 15 feet high at the center, and the crew compartment to accommodate at least three persons in atmospheric comfort and safety under the normal conditions to be anticipated in flight to within 1,000 miles away from the Earth. And the price? $20 million. Additional identical units on the same schedule, $4 million. Delivery, approximately 24 months at quoted prices or in less time, subject to upward revision of price to minimum of approximately 6 months. My other guests this morning, Nell Chaloney, Roy Benson, Ben Iskowitz, and Dave Bell. Nell Chaloney?
Mr. Carr, LJ has just finished reading a paragraph from one of the bulletins that you put out, quoting the price on the OXC1. I believe that's the correct...
OTCX1.
OTCX1, excuse
that's
me.
Right.
He mentioned the price as being $20 million. I have in front of me an information bulletin number 3 dated December the 23rd, 1957, in which you are quoted as having offered, quote, to build and deliver to the government without one penny of risk to the American taxpayer said vehicle. Now, how do you mean to accomplish this in view of the fact that you're going to charge $20 million?
Our plans at this time were that that this would be privately financed if we had the order.
Could you amplify on that?
We had contact with people who had agreed to privately finance us if we had the order.
And why hasn't the order been forthcoming?
Apparently, those whom we contacted in the Department of Defense were not interested in our proposal.
Have you contacted them recently?
Not recently, no, sir.
Don't you think that it might be a good idea in view of the entire post-Sputnik atmosphere in Washington?
We are open for suggestions along this line. But most assuredly, all the officials in Washington must know about us and our plans.
It occurs to me that if you sent a letter like this to the Russian embassy, you might get a reaction from them that, for some reasons, would not be forthcoming from our own government. Should this come about, the resultant publicity that you would be bound to get would certainly call attention to what you're trying to accomplish.
As Director of Public Relations and Sales Engineering for OTC Enterprises, I would like to say emphatically that we would not consider or contemplate any such action.
No, I didn't mean it.
I understand how you project it, but I don't want it to go out on the air without me making sure it's properly qualified.
Well, admittedly, my interest in this entire scheme that you're projecting, I use the word scheme for lack of a better one, without any connotations, is my interest in this is that it would seem to be the golden opportunity for the United States to be able to recapture the center of world attention with regard to scientific advancement. And assuming that the invention will do what it, the things that it'll do, the things that are claimed for it.
Now, we have great hopes. Excuse me.
This would be the paramount issue on getting the government to be interested enough, at least, to take a look at one of the thousands of working models that you've made.
We have great hopes that the new approaches to space exploration, such as the proposed space agency and the committee headed by Congressman McCormick, which is now studying all of the aspects of approaches to space exploration and the manufacture of devices to carry man into space, will provide the unity and singularity and impartiality of thought and approach to the whole subject that perhaps has not been practical under the setup of the conventional defense agencies whose interests have been apparently confined to rocketry and missiles and the uses of combustible chemical fuels of various kinds. We hope and we feel sure that Congressman McCormick's committee will explore every possibility relating to space exploration.
I have what at first glance might seem to be a very naive question. If thousands of working models have been built, as director of promotion, wasn't it at all possible for you to see to it that at least one of these thousands were called to the attention of someone in government? Couldn't you walk into your congressman's office with this working model and say, look what I've got, let's see if you can use it?
It has been said by the philosophers that if you understand principle, you understand the machine. These principles, and as a matter of fact, the OTCX-1 spacecraft essentially has only two moving parts rotating on a single central axle or axis. Total disclosure demonstration, premature to our total security of self-determination and our opportunity to manufacture and design prototypes for application to many purposes, would be somewhat jeopardized by premature disclosure.
You quote, you quote the philosopher that the principle is easier to put forward than the, what was that quote again?
Well, I'll give it to you by a more familiar analogy that never seen a wheel, it would take only one look at a wheel and you could manufacture wheels.
Well, the native philosopher says, I'm from Missouri, show me, and it appears to me that that's the easiest way. And I'm going to anticipate Ben's question. You're assuming that the government would steal the invention without giving you due credit, as I understand your right thing.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't even subscribe to it. I would say that we want to make sure of our self-determination before we make total disclosure demonstrations in private or in public. However, as I said earlier in the program, if anyone were willing to write out an order for a full-scale craft before we would pick up the order and begin to perform on it, we would be willing to manufacture and demonstrate a miniature prototype model that would prove beyond any doubt our ability to manufacture the full-scale craft.
We're talking this morning with O.T. Carr, president of OTC Enterprises Incorporated, and Norman Evans Colton, director of sales engineering. Ben Iskwith is with us, Roy Benson, and Mel Cialone.
Do you want to read that telegram, Ben, please?
Yes. It's from our friend A. Osgood again. Ben, refer gentlemen to Norbert Wiener communications theory. 3 hours questions minus zero answers. My field, thermo and high velocity research. If Carr correct, I burn lab Monday a.m. P.S. Dr. Zacharias, also MIT, should be mildly disturbed. Signed, A. Osgood.
I have a match.
Any comment there, Mr. Carr?
No comment.
All right. Fair enough. Mel?
Yes, I have a number of questions. Getting back...
Don't forget, gentlemen, if I may interrupt again just briefly. We want to get into the photon gun, too, after a little while.
Photon gun.
Photon, I'm sorry. Thank you very much, Ben. I'm very happy that you are here with us this morning because it's these little corrections that help to build me to be a bigger and a better Roy Benson.
That's like humidity.
It's humidity.
Humidity.
So many people mispronounce that. It's humidity. That's a Mantler pronunciation, if I'm not mistaken.
It comes from the Atlantic state region.
Atlantic. Atlantic. Some people pronounce it Atlantic. It's Atlantic.
Well, Mr. Colton, it seems to me that you don't have a very high opinion of the governmental policies that are now in force, because in one of your information bulletins, number 2, dated November 28, 1957, you extend an open hand to industry and offer them, let me see if I could find the quote here, I had it here a minute ago. At any rate, you offer them the opportunity to view the devices that you have in your laboratory and for them to mention their requirements in various industries, and yet you deny firsthand witness of what has been accomplished in the laboratory to the United States government.
I'm sorry that the announcement that you're reading from seems to create that impression. That is not the fact. You see, this Utron electrical accumulator has many applications, has many forms, many variations. There are applications to many industrial uses. In one sense, you might describe it as an energized armature, or in other words, a motor with a self-contained moving battery, also capable of continuously re-energizing itself. The offer that stands in regard to the spacecraft applies to government and industry alike. We will only make total disclosure demonstrations after we have secured a firm order. In other words, we're not looking for anyone to evaluate our development. Mr. Carr has spent 20 years in this research. He doesn't need any risk money, either from the taxpayers or from industry, for further exploration and development. He is willing to show to anyone who is a sincere prospective purchaser, but not just to anyone who comes along out of curiosity.
Well, Mr. Colton, I, for the sake of argument, will go along with the premise that government, by its very nature, would be slow-moving and not at all receptive to new devices that would displace a lot of manpower and a lot of budgetary expenditures that have gone on in the past. However, I fail to see where some corporation like General Motors would not come to you and say, gentlemen, I'd like to see what you have. I'd like to see as much as you'll show me. I'm prepared to follow through on this, if only I interject parenthetically to buy up certain patents if there are such in existence, or in any way to secure rights and privileges that would prevent a competitor getting their hands on something that is able to furnish power for automobiles.
No OTC product or patent will ever be available on any such basis. This is the reason for our concern to have complete self-determination, so that this new energy system can be made available equally to all people everywhere.
Let me put it to you this way. Has any representative of any automobile manufacturing corporation in the United States seen fit to communicate with you regarding this series of inventions?
We've had a great many communications. We have not yet had any direct, formal, official
negotiations. After 18 years, what do you attribute this flaw to?
This is like the when did you stop beating your wife. I have to accept your adjective, flaw. I won't use it myself. I will say that throughout the development of technology in this country and some others, there has been a tendency to maintain the status quo, to carry out existing production by existing means as long as there are willing markets. I noticed the other day in a magazine advertisement by a metals manufacturer, an illustration of a gas turbine engine, which is predicted to be the motive power for the automobile of the near future. This gas turbine engine, similarly to the principles of electromagnetic propulsion, which Mr. Carr has perfected, has been known in principle, in practice, and in prototype for many years. Your automobile is still powered by an internal combustion engine, and I am not qualified to tell you why.
Mr. Cullen, what does Utron mean?
Utron is a coined word. It's a word Mr. Carr put together from the letter U and Tron. U meaning the direction or shape of motion as applied and used and equated in this accumulator or this battery that we described.
U represents the direction?
U is the plane geometrical figure that is a portrait of the wave, you might say.
How do you square the use of plane geometry with the concept you have involving the fourth dimension?
I say that the letter U, as described on paper, is a two-dimensional and therefore plane figure, which is a portrait on paper of the wave, or the wave motion, which is put to use to produce straight-line pressure energies in the neutron accumulator.
Now, I don't know what you said. I mean, could you break it down for me?
I, in answering for Mr. Colton, because it is more or less my development, to me, there is no such thing as a completed curve. It only goes halfway. It's like you only go halfway in the woods and then you're coming out. And this is the same. The bisection of any
told sphere is its exact center, and one half of it is primarily U-shaped. Because in magnets there are always two poles, and in a naturally one of the normal ways to show them is in a U-shape. But if it's in a bar magnet, there are still two poles, and the shape is still the same. We can only put a rope halfway around the tree, and it is coming around the other way. And this is true in all wave motion. Now, if you extend this into...
What is true in all wave motion?
If you extend this into velocity, you get the force fit. And this is a pattern of the sine wave and definitely the electromagnetic wave.
Oh, I see. I mean, the apex and the cusp of the wave.
This is true.
All motion is relative to all other motion, and so it performs this serpentine spiral shape in completing its cycle.
Well, it's not performing that motion. That motion is the graph of an equation representing the motion.
But the form...
Well, I'll accept the fact that you call it a U-tron. I mean,
yes.
And that's how you got it.
And also, this form in its dimensions is well exemplified in the geometry of our accumulator.
Why do you refer the space vehicle as a fourth-dimensional space vehicle?
Because the geometry of this accumulator is definitely fourth-dimensional.
How? Because I hate to ask these one-word questions, but I'm stuck with them.
To me, the application of space and time.
Well,
the vibratory field. And electricity, as we know it, as being a vibratory force in motion, this is symbolic of it, and when it is activated, it becomes such. Now, this may be a little bit difficult to understand, but nevertheless, the very smallest electronic particles of matter have been shown under the highest type of electron microscopes to be in one dimension square.
Electrons?
Yes. They have been the smallest particles.
No one's ever seen an electron under...
The electron particles have been so photographed, the smallest particles of matter. This has only come out of the laboratory recently. But if this was dimensional, they would be definitely conical and almost identical in shape with our accumulator.
I may have heard wrong, Mr. Carr. You said electrons were photographed by the electron microscope.
The particles, the smallest particles of matter, naturally...
Do you mean electrons?
Not necessarily, not exactly electrons, no, but the smallest particles of matter that they've been able to photograph have come up square.
How does that relate to the fact that your vehicle is a four-dimensional vehicle?
Because this, to me, this photograph is verification from this atomic laboratory that this is truly a space dimension because it is the shape of matter. Without matter, you couldn't have space. They're synonymous.
You got a telegram.
So, may I read it?
It's a good question.
Translate it for us? Please comment type of sound projected by this craft. William Woodward.
There would be very little sound at any distance from it. In the close proximity, it would have the hum of a high-voltage motor.
Sort of a whirring sound?
That's
a humming
right.
sound?
That's right.
I see. Well, is it that you can't exactly divulge the essential principle of this because of patent... the patent situation?
Almost all of the essential principles have been discussed here this evening.
Well, it does seem vague to me. Now, I admit stupidity about the thing, actually. But this is the thing, the central unit, the core.
I think you should describe it to everyone.
I'm holding a thing that looked like two
The only thing I can think of are two loud